Why did South Florida become Tornado Alley? Why are South Florida landmarks being neglected? And why has South Florida been relatively untouched by Tren de Aragua? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the spate of deadly tornadoes spawned by Hurricane Milton last week, 26 of them, which made Florida feel more like Kansas. We'll also discuss WLRN's new series, Culture of Neglect, which looks at efforts to restore Miami's important but too often uncared for cultural institutions. And we'll examine the violent Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Aragua that's now at the center of the presidential election's immigration debate. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Milton, the powerful hurricane that tore across Florida's midsection from Gulf Coast to Atlantic Coast last week, felt more like a shrapnel bomb than a storm. That's because it spun off more than two dozen equally powerful tornadoes. The National Weather Service counted 26 of them. That's more than half the average number of tornadoes Florida sees in an entire year. And three of them registered EF3 strength, with wind speeds of more than 140 miles per hour. It was the first time tornadoes that powerful had been recorded in South Florida using a new scale introduced in 2007, and Palm Beach County was hard hit, including Todd Jobin's house in Wellington.
Portions of our garage door went through the house, through the sliding glass door, and into our backyard. If my son had just gotten home right before that hit, he could have actually been in the garage when that happened. We're very thankful that everybody is safe.
Even nearby residents whose homes weren't hit, like Dylan Metz, were shaken by what they saw.
I was not expecting that many tornadoes hitting South Florida, and especially this one that came a couple hundred yards away from our house.
Six people were killed in a tornado in St. Lucie County, north of Palm Beach, and the destruction the twisters left behind made much of Florida's landscape look more like the Kansas Plains, a scene from The Wizard of Oz instead of Key Largo. What caused such a ferocious outbreak of Midwest-style tornadoes, and can we expect this as a new climate change normal, too? Did you happen to witness any of these tornadoes? Were you affected by them? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help us make sense of this phenomenon is WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always great to have you on.
Thanks, Tim.
And with us from West Palm Beach is WLRN's Palm Beach reporter, Wilkin Brutus. Wilkin, how are you?
Hey, Tim. Hey, Jenny.
Hey.
How you doing? Jenny, I'm from Indiana, and I was certainly used to tornado activity growing up. But even a Midwestern twister veteran like me was astonished by what Milton unleashed last week. And so it seems from your reporting the same thing. Were the climate scientists and weather experts that taken aback by this, and what impressed them most about this?
I think it was the intensity and the number. Hurricanes will spin off tornadoes, but they're often much weaker, so they sort of get lost in the hurricane winds. Mm-hmm. But these were, like you pointed out, three EF tornadoes that lasted. The one that hit St. Lucie County ran along for 30, I think more than 30 minutes before it dissipated.
And remind people, that's a long period for any tornado, whether it's here or in Kansas.
Yes.
To trail along like that. What does cause hurricanes to spawn off tornadoes?
Well, it destabilizes the atmosphere. You get, you know, wet, an atmosphere coming off the water and colliding with dry air.
Okay.
Milton was different, though.
Why?
Because Milton came from the Western Gulf where it formed and traveled almost directly across the Gulf, very hot waters, a lot of moisture, came ashore and collided with dry air well advance of the storm. The tornadoes hit. The first one was at 4:30 in the morning,
right,
off Florida City, when Milton was still well offshore. So those tornadoes...
And when it was still well offshore, it was still very, very strong.
Yes.
Okay.
And though that moist air was that those outer bands were well ahead of Milton. So you know, we've got our eyes set on the storm, like
right.
Winds of hurricane
the, on
hit.
The eye way out in the Gulf, but we maybe weren't paying enough attention to the bands and what they were doing as they were making landfall.
Right, right.
Right. That's fascinating. And that sort of created a tornado hyper phenomenon, though, then in that regard, no?
Right. And so that moist air where it was colliding with the dry air was outside Milton's cloud cover. So Michael Lowry at WPLG explained this to me, because
right,
this
sure.
was all new to me, like you.
Yeah.
Unlike you, yeah. I am not from the Midwest.
I'm a Hoosier. Okay.
Yes. I'm used to hurricanes, not tornadoes. Mm-hmm. But he said normally when these tornadoes appear in a hurricane, they're under the cloud cover. And the cloud cover keeps them from becoming super intense. These appeared beyond Milton's cloud cover, and so that allowed them to really kick into.
What's interesting to me is that you're using the dynamic of wet and dry air. In the Midwest, as I was growing up, we were always taught it's a dynamic of cool and warm air. Warm air coming up from the Gulf, colliding with cold air coming down from, say, you know, Canada or the Arctic, and then we in the Midwest get caught in the middle, and that's why we're the traditional tornado alley. Is that an accurate way of sort of pointing out the difference between the two?
I think so. It's what destabilizes the atmosphere.
Right, whatever destabilizes the atmosphere, right. Wilkin, you spoke with folks up in Wellington and other Palm Beach County communities. They, like everyone else in that part of the state, were girding for a hurricane. Instead, they got tornadoes. How do they describe to you what they saw and, more important, what they felt?
Yeah, I mean, even as a reporter, I'm a Palm Beach County resident. I was obviously quite shocked. They were devastated, Tim. I mean, nearly 150 homes in the village of Wellington were impacted. Some
wow.
actually destroyed. I walked through and reported from the preserve at Binks Forest. It's a pretty wealthy neighborhood in Wellington, and you could feel the sense of shock and grief in the air.
Yeah.
You played a clip of Todd Jobin.
Yeah.
That's my reporting. Just outside of his home, he told me a portion of his collapsed garage door went through his house. That's indicative of the power of this EF3 tornado, you know?
Yeah, and we should point out, you know, as you just pointed out, this is an affluent community. This is the sort of community where you would expect impact windows and things of that nature to be all set in place for hurricanes, but yet it seems like a tornado was a different animal when it came at these houses, right?
A completely different animal. In fact, I spoke to their mayor, and he said that some of the impact windows actually failed.
Wow.
Again, another example for a Florida man like myself to know that tornadoes are much more fierce than hurricanes. That same homeowner, Todd Jobin, described, you know, the whistling sound of the tornado as something he had never heard before.
Right. In the Midwest, we always would refer to it as the sound of a freight train coming through our communities. Yeah. Did anybody describe it like that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he said that gust felt instant. And you could see it just next door. His neighbor's car had flipped, crashed, and pinned into his neighbor's front porch. When I got there, people were using chainsaws to release this car.
Right.
I mean, the destruction was swift, and that's the through line I kept hearing from that particular neighborhood.
So the kind of destruction they got was obviously not the kind of destruction they were expecting if they had been hit by a hurricane.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you played another clip of Dylan Metz, this high school swimmer who I spoke to. And he's from a completely different neighborhood, but it's pretty close by. And you could see the differences in terms of how the kids were reacting to it. Shocked, but also awe. Homeowners are obviously thinking about insurances.
Sure.
But even Dylan said he's looking at tornado warnings completely differently now. And that's another through line I kept hearing is that, oh, wow, from now on, we're going to have to sort of take tornado warnings very seriously.
Yeah. Jenny, tell us about the tornado strength measurement scale I mentioned at the outset that weather officials now use, because as we mentioned, three of last week's twisters were EF3, or the tornado equivalent of a Category 5 hurricane. Is that an accurate way of putting it? How do they measure tornadoes differently, if at all, from the way they gauge hurricanes? Is it all just about wind speed, or are there other criteria?
No, it's called a scale because they take into account damage and winds. They try to marry the two to get a more accurate reading of the risk. The wind speeds that you talk about are gusts. They're not sustained mm-hmm. winds. In a hurricane, when we say it's a Category 4, it's because the winds are sustained and right. not so in a tornado. So for in Palm Beach County, for example, the one that hit Wellington was an EF3.
Right.
And it lasted for 35 minutes. There were two others that touched down around Lion Country Safari
yeah.
that traveled 35 miles. They don't know there can also be EFUs, which are right. unknown. Sometimes they can see evidence of wind damage, but they just don't have the radar information.
And
to back
being
up.
EF3, again, that's the equivalent of wind speeds or gusts of 140 miles per hour or more, no?
Yeah, I think it's 140 to 165. And the EF3s that they recorded in Milton were between 140 and 155.
Right. And to put that in perspective, hurricane-wise, that is the equivalent of a Cat 5 storm, right?
Which has sustained winds.
Sustained, okay. Whereas the tornadoes we're talking about, it's more gusts.
Right. Well, I mean, and they're short-lived, right?
Right.
Like a hurricane is here, and you can go through hours of a hurricane where these short, the tornadoes, when they touch down, they spin, and they dissipate.
A tornado
depending.
Is just one right jab to the jaw, whereas a hurricane is just like constant pummeling.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That's important to know. Wilkin, as we mentioned earlier, sadly, six people were killed north of Palm Beach County in St. Lucie County in a mobile home park. Can you tell us about the tornado that struck that community and what caused those tragic deaths?
Yeah, and I'd also like to add to that that there were no reported deaths in Wellington as well.
Okay, great. That's great to know, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, it's extremely unfortunate. St. Lucie County Sheriff named six people who had died as a direct result of that tornado, which had flipped cars, flattened homes in the Spanish Lakes Country Club Village, which is essentially a senior retirement community near Fort Pierce. And the sheriff team also rescued more than 2 dozen people as well. Again, like I said earlier, the same exact sort of description of a swift destruction that laid bare in that particular community.
Mm-hmm. So, Jenny and Wilkham, one big question I have as a result of all this, if either of you can tell us, is there any sense that if the Spanish Lakes Mobile Home Park tragedy, for example, if that mobile home park had just been hit at that time by Hurricane Milton, which was a much weaker Cat 1 storm by the time it got to Florida's Atlantic coast, that we perhaps would not have seen the fatalities there that we saw after a strong tornado hit that area, if you understand the distinction I'm trying to make.
I do, but I also keep in mind mobile homes are risky places to be.
Sure, in any storm, right.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. So it's kind of hard to say because it was inland. I would say the storm surge that is most destructive in a hurricane wouldn't have occurred,
okay.
So that's good.
Uh-huh.
The other thing, the difference between hurricanes and tornadoes, hurricanes, you have warning, they're coming. Tornadoes are very sudden.
Right. Wilkin, though, any sense from your conversations with people up there that they almost sort of wish we had been hit by the hurricane instead of the tornado?
Yeah, to echo Jenny here, it's the fact that these tornadoes are sudden. The age and construction of those mobile homes, I would add, that were much older, but I can't really speculate on what could have happened with a weaker
right.
storm.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a senior community with some residents with potential medical conditions
right.
and other challenges. But I doubt Cat 1 hurricane would have done
right.
what this tornado did. And just remember what I said earlier, in Wellington, the mayor told me hurricane-proof windows had failed.
Right.
And so, yeah.
But I appreciate that point you're both making about the suddenness of a tornado versus
right.
the prep time that we have before a hurricane arrives, and that's something I think very important.
You seek shelter
absolutely.
In a tornado,
sure.
you evacuate in a hurricane.
Exactly.
Yep.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich and Wilkin Brutus about the unusual and unusually strong spate of tornadoes that hit us last week during Hurricane Milton and what this might mean for storms in the future. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Jenny, about that issue I just raised, let's pivot ahead here now.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you if you get the sense from climate scientists and weather experts that the ramped-up tornado phenomenon Florida saw last week is just one more, quote, new normal that climate change has wrought here. When hurricanes tend to move inland now, should Floridians be preparing for twisters as a sort of, as I said before, shrapnel from the storm grenade, as it were?
Well, so there are some studies that say tornadoes will get worse. tornadoes that spawn from hurricanes, though, is still kind of a question mark. And these Milton will provide a lot of evidence, I think. A lot of people are going to be looking more closely to see what that connection is. We know that climate change is making hurricanes more intense, rainfall in hurricanes more intense. So
the question becomes, how do climate change and global warming perhaps serve as factors that scientists say have been turbocharging hurricanes? Are they also turbocharging tornado strength and activity too?
Tornadoes connected to hurricanes.
Right,
because remember,
exactly,
we have two different scenarios.
Okay, good distinction. Thanks. What then are the most important things Floridians need to start appreciating about tornadoes? Again, this isn't Kansas. This is new to most folks here. How should they augment their storm preparation routine now in the face of this? We mentioned before, realize that a tornado is going to give you a lot less time to get ready.
Right. And boy, that's a good question. I think that now we know that there can be a risk and it can be far from where the hurricane makes landfall.
Uh-huh.
So you have just got to pay attention to what your local weather office is telling you. I heard people say after the tornadoes that they got the alerts. They heard the alerts for the tornadoes.
Yeah.
So take them more
seriously.
We have
to pay a lot more attention to the bands coming in advance of the hurricane's landfall rather than just the hurricane's landfall now, it seems.
Right, right. And your local weather office, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to get the alerts now. I mean, you have to have a smartphone almost, but they're coming at you. They're issuing them.
Wilkin, how are residents and officials up there in Palm Beach County, as well as counties like Glades and St. Lucie that got hit by this, how are they recovering now after three EF3 strength tornadoes ripped through their communities?
Yeah, I also want to piggyback on Jenny's point.
Sure.
A lot of residents said that they were inundated with the amount of information that they kept getting. So hopefully local officials can streamline that information.
Right, because now we're having to deal with two layers of information.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. But how are they recovering now, perhaps differently from this than they would have been if it had just been a hurricane hitting them?
Yeah, so cities are trying to manage manpower, equipment, and resources as they continue to assess damages and other needs. So Wellington Mayor Michael Napoleon, for example, told me this week they lacked disaster equipment because they're obviously competing with the state and other cities. But as of today, they have nearly two dozen trucks that are removing tons of mostly vegetation like tree debris. So
right.
It's a huge improvement from earlier mm-hmm. this week. Wellington is also working with multiple agencies such as FEMA and established a resource center at Village Park for anyone who's listening to SFR right now in Wellington to assist residents with the emergency needs.
Finally, Jenny, I also just wanted to ask you in the 30 seconds we have left about not just the tornadoes, but the hurricane that spawned them, Milton. It grew from a Cat 1 to a Cat 5 storm out in the Gulf of Mexico at astonishing speed. Are scientists pretty convinced that global warming, and especially how global warming has turned the Gulf waters into a hot tub, really, was a contributing factor to the turbocharging of Milton and
yes.
other recent
yes.
storms?
Yes, the Gulf is heating up at twice the rate of the global average for oceans, and there is the loop current that many storms pass over. That loop current carries hot water from the
yeah.
Caribbean, and we can see the path of the current and what storms are crossing when they speed up. There's other conditions, I should
sure.
say.
No, but
as you know,
just,
there's lack
just,
of wind shear that
yeah.
can, if there were more wind shear, that would have kept the storm weaker, but it wasn't there.
But we just want to remind people about the hurricane phenomenon as well that spawned all of this.
Yes.
Jenny Stiletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach reporter. Many thanks, as always, to you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, how to save Miami's cultural jewels from a culture of Miami neglect. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Miami may be a relatively young city, but it's known for cultural landmarks, from Calle Ocho to the Wynwood Walls, from the Freedom Tower to the Vizcaya Estate. But Miami, unfortunately, is also known for a culture of neglect when it comes to these sites, from the historic downtown Olympia Theater to the Little Haiti Cultural Complex. Community leaders are battling disrepair, if not abandonment, in an effort to restore the historic jewels that helped make the Magic City magic before they're lost for good. A new WLRN series of reports on this urgent issue is called, not coincidentally, Culture of Neglect. It examines how Miami landmarks like the Marine Stadium on Virginia Key or the Tower Theater in Little Havana have fallen victim to municipal indifference and what citizens are now trying to do to reverse it. Our four-part Culture of Neglect series aired this week, and the hope is that it will prompt Miami and Miamians to cast attention on more than just the cultural gems we spotlighted. Do you see a culture of neglect when it comes to Miami's cultural landmarks? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio are two of the WLRN journalists who took part in the Culture of Neglect series, investigative reporter Danny Rivero and our very own South Florida Roundup producer, Jimena Romero. How are you guys doing? And congratulations on the series.
Thanks, Tim. Doing good.
Danny, this series was your brainchild. What prompted you and Jimena and another WLRN journalist, our government accountability reporter Joshua Ceballos, to look at these several Miami cultural landmarks that have fallen into disrepair, if not actual abandonment, as I said?
Thanks for the question, and it's a pleasure to do this kind of reporting. I mean, the real way that I came up with the concept is that I live here.
Sure.
And... you know, not too long ago, I used these cultural institutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I used to go to films every so often at the Tower Theater.
Yeah.
My tia abuela, my grandmom's sister, went for years to see Spanish films. And when it shut down, when the city took it over, she asked me, like, where am I going to see these films?
No, when I moved here in 1999, in the early 2000s, I used to go to a lot of films.
Exactly.
There,
yeah. And then the Olympia Theater. I mean, I was there. There was a comedian, Hannibal Buress, did a big special there a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, that was broadcasted all over the world, shot at the Olympia Theater. The Olympia Theater is not operating right now. You know, the Marine Stadium. I've never been to the Marine Stadium. It's still there. What's going on with it? So it's just like living and seeing what's going on, and then just doing the reporting to see what's actually going on here.
Sort of feels like you're looking at some holes in the place you've grown up in.
Exactly.
Yeah. When did it become apparent, though, that what you were seeing wasn't just isolated incidents of neglect, but rather a troubling trend that sort of urgently calls out for collective correction here?
I'll use an example from the story that I did about the Tower Theater. The Tower Theater used to host a variety of film festivals, the Miami International Film Festival, Third Horizon Film Festival.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when I talked to one of the Third Horizon directors, he told me, we used to host it at the Tower Theater. And then, you know, if we didn't do it there, we used to host some showings at the Olympia Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Olympia Theater shut down, we hosted some things at the Little Haiti Cultural Center. And then they had issues, so we're left scrambling. And he just literally went down the line of all these city-owned properties that are all facing different issues encapsulated by the issues of one film festival that used to have a home.
That chain was hard to ignore then, right? Jimena, you reported this week on the Little Haiti Cultural Center that Danny just mentioned, which is without a doubt one of Miami's cultural jewels. But as we've often discussed on this program, one of the more municipally neglected, unfortunately. What stood out for you in your reporting about how the Little Haiti Cultural Center came to this point and what the community and the city are now doing to correct it, if anything?
Yeah, well, not long ago, the community members of the Little Haiti neighborhood were very frustrated and like very angry about how the city was managing this facility, because, you know, they would go to the theater and the AC wasn't working. They would be in the Caribbean Marketplace and there would be leaks from the roof,
yeah,
from all these heavy rains that we had this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the last straw was, you know, the Caribbean Marketplace actually closed in June.
Yeah.
And ever since then, you know, the Kunyata Warren, who was the director of the complex, you know, in July, he resigned. And we talked about it in the program.
Sure.
For sure. And he cited, you know, this systemic issues when it came about the city, you know, managing this property. And you know, and in talking about my conversations with community members, they had this feeling that the city was just not in like it, they didn't have in their priorities this space like other cultural institutions in the city, and it was just like this sense of them being neglected, right, and you know, forgotten in a way.
But the center is starting to get a little bit more priority now as a result of
exactly.
all this controversy, right?
Exactly, and mm-hmm. it seems that you know the fact that Warren left the way that he did,
right?
You know, really. You know, push the city to start making these changes. And just, you know, 2 months after he did leave, they started addressing them.
Okay.
You know, now the Parks and Recreation, who's the department that manages the property, they mm-hmm. have been going to every single rehabilitation trust meeting mm-hmm. to give updates to the community.
That's important to know. Let's play here the first report in the Culture of Neglect series. It's by Josh Ceballos about the historic Olympia Theater, which has been a fixture in downtown Miami for almost a century. I mean, Elvis Presley performed there, but these days it's in ragged condition and is rarely open.
The Olympia Theater has hosted musical legends like the King himself.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show. You get ready now, go.
But the theater has seen better days. Long-time structural issues mean the Olympia is closed most of the year.
It's safe to occupy. It's just not, you know, it doesn't have a clean bill of health.
That's Andrew Frey. He's director of the City of Miami Real Estate Department that owns and manages the Olympia property. Frey says the theater is in the middle of its 40-year building recertification, and that's probably going to take a while.
So the city has to address the issues identified in the 40-year recertification report and make those repairs.
Repairs that include interior damage and cracks on the building's facade. In the meantime, the Olympia hosts occasional walking exhibits, the most recent one being a Lego event this past January, though a new one has not yet been announced and the building is currently closed. I'm Joshua Ceballos in Miami.
Danny, you also reported on, as you mentioned, the historic Miami Theater as part of the Culture and Neglect series, and that's the Tower Theater in Little Havana.
That's right.
What stood out for you about its problems and possible solutions, like the 100 events planned for next year?
So the issues at the Tower Theater are somewhat different than the Olympia Theater. What happened with the Tower Theater is 2 years ago, the city of Miami stopped leasing the building to Miami-Dade College. Miami-Dade College had been running the Tower Theater for 20 years, frankly, without any incidents. Nobody mm-hmm. had any complaints about it. It was operating almost every day. They were showing films there. And then from one day to the next, you know, the district commissioner, Joe Carollo, said, the city wants it back. We're gonna take this back. The city is going to operate it. So his mm-hmm. office took direct control over the theater. And I talked to Susie Battle, who's the owner of Azucar Ice Cream, the ice cream shop directly across the street from the Tower right. Theater, who, as she said, you know, this is all I look at every day. I only look at the Tower Theater out my window, and I'm telling you, it's closed. They are not using this mm-hmm. space. And
but this coming year could provide
right.
some relief.
That was her, you know. It was run by the district commissioner's office, and then about 6 months ago, the city administration took control over it, and now the city says, okay, we're starting to develop this thing, and we have 100 events booked for the following year, which I did the math, and I said, okay, that's about one-third of the days, less than a third of the days, and then they yeah. clarified, there's two rooms, so you can have more than one event per day because there's two spaces. So it's still not really being used, but they do say that they're making progress in booking it. But I will add, it's not as a theater. Okay. It was a cinema. It's not being used necessarily as a cinema right now.
Right. Okay. Well, at least there's some movement. But you also took a look at the iconic Miami Marines Stadium over on Virginia Key. That's not just a valuable cultural landmark, but a special immigration story as well, right? Tell us about that.
Right. I mean, the story of the Marine Stadium, again, it's one of those things like you can't ignore. If you drive on the Rickenbacker Causeway, you see it. It's all tagged up. It's run down. It's been like that for a long time. It's been abandoned by the city since Hurricane Andrew.
Yeah.
It's been closed longer than it was
God,
open.
Yeah, that is a long time.
It's 32 years and counting closed, and
yeah.
the city still hasn't done what everyone acknowledges needs to be done.
Yeah.
But the story of it's fascinating because the Cuban architect Hilario Candela came right mm-hmm. after the Cuban Revolution, Castro mm-hmm. came to power. 27 years old, designed it and built it, and it's internationally recognized as an architectural gem.
Yeah.
It's a gem of a building. And, well, you know, we used to go there as teenagers just to you know, do shenanigans and stuff and sneak in.
Yeah.
But I've never known that building to be open. To me, it's only been known as an abandoned structure. And, you know, you talk to older people that remember using it, and they say, what a gem that was. And if you could go down the line of people that have been fighting to preserve and bring this back, and they're dying. These people are dying. It's very sad.
Maybe reviving that story about the architect will help galvanize more of that effort. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero and Jimena Romero about the station's new series, Culture of Neglect, about the efforts to save Miami's too often uncared for cultural landmarks. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And if you miss any part of this or other conversations, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, man, I want to take a step back here right now and look at a bigger picture that I think this series evokes. And I want to put this question to you first, because you're an especially young Miamian. As a Gen Z Miamian, how did working on this series affect your awareness of your city's cultural history and its importance?
Yeah, and one of the things that I love about my job is that, you know, you get to learn about things that, you know, you live in the city and then you might not be aware of them before, mm-hmm. the same way that you are also trying to tell others to raise awareness on. And yeah, definitely it was the same case with this story. I got to really see how, you know, beloved this place is for the Haitian diaspora here in Miami. You know, how it has served for, you know, speakers to be there. You know, we had a president go, I think President Biden had a speech there once. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, and just for their daily activities as well, dance classes. I got to go to a dance class a few Saturdays ago, and it was just lovely to see them dance. I think it's called Kumpa. Kumpa. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The song, the music genre that they dance to, and mm-hmm. it was just amazing to be immersed in their culture, which is the whole purpose of this area. And then they are very proud about it, and they talk about how it's a place where they want to, like, not only Haitian Americans to come or the Haitian diaspora to come, but also people from other cultures to get to experience it as well.
No, people forget Little Haiti Cultural Center is also a very significant tourist destination.
Exactly.
In Miami. Danny, now you're a comparative oldster and you're a longtime resident of Miami, as you pointed out, native born here. But I still want to ask you that same question. How did working on this series give you perhaps a new appreciation of Miami's cultural history and its importance in terms of providing this relatively young city with a foundation for becoming a better city moving ahead?
You know, one thing I didn't actually realize going into this is both the Olympia Theater in downtown Miami, which is, by the way, in the middle of this massive construction effort to make Flagler Street in downtown Miami more pedestrian friendly.
Right.
At the very center of that multi-million dollar project is the Olympia Theater, which is basically shut down, right?
Right.
The Olympia Theater is turning 100 years old in 2 years. I actually didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Tower Theater in Little Havana is turning 100 years old in 2 years as well. They both opened in 1926. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, man, we are a young city, but we actually have history here. We're about to hit triple digits. That's not a minor thing for landmarks.
And as you
like
point
this.
Out with the Flagler project there, these aren't not just cultural, you know, institutions. These are development anchors in much of a sense, right?
It should be. I mean, there's no way around that. You have a pedestrian zone that's basically built to be the Lincoln Road of downtown Miami. In the middle of it is a theater that is not operational,
but which should be a magnet. Yeah.
It should be hosting huge events. I mean, a couple of years ago, they were doing that.
Danny Rivero and Jimena Romero are WLRN journalists whose reports were part of this week's series, Culture of Neglect. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, what is Tren de Aragua and why could it help turn the presidential election
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. In recent years, few if any migrant groups have come over the U.S. southern border in greater numbers than Venezuelans. In fact, almost a quarter of Venezuela's population has left that country over the past decade. They're escaping the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history, not to mention one of the hemisphere's most brutal dictatorships. Among those millions of Venezuelans flocking to the U.S. and countless other countries, there are, not surprisingly, some violent criminals. Most notorious are a gang called Tren de Aragua, or the Aragua Train, named for the Venezuelan state where its founders were imprisoned. They're an alarming menace in countries like Chile and Colombia, but their presence in U.S. cities like Aurora, Colorado, and San Antonio, Texas, is now an immigration issue for former President Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Yet, does Tren de Aragua have as big a presence here in South Florida, home to the U.S.'s largest Venezuelan community? Are you aware of Tren de Aragua? Are they a genuine concern in the U.S., or are they election hype? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Bogota, Colombia, is my friend and colleague Juan Forero, South America bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, who recently published an illuminating report on Tren de Aragua and what U.S. law enforcement fears from it. Juan, thanks for taking the time down there to talk with us.
Hi, Tim. It's a pleasure.
You and I have both been reporting this year on Tren de Aragua's expansion in this hemisphere. For our listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with the gang, can you brief us on who they are, where and how the gang formed in Venezuela, and more important, how it suddenly exported itself throughout South America and eventually into the U.S.?
Oh, of course, sure. The gang, as you mentioned in your introduction, they're from Aragua State, which is in the center of Venezuela. This is a prison-based gang, which is a phenomenon we see in many Latin American countries,
right,
where gangs form among convicts inside of prison, and they give orders and carry out crimes outside of prisons because they have their allies outside. This gang is relatively new. It's about a decade old, and it started in the Tocoron prison, as it's known, and they're involved in all kinds of different crimes, you know, everything from assassinations, hits against rivals, to small-time drug trafficking, to extortion. And then they just grew. They increasingly grew. And then in the more recent years, these gangs have popped up wherever Venezuelan migrants have popped up. And what's actually happened, as you noted, is, you know, a quarter of the population has left Venezuela. We're talking about 8 million people. And they've gone all through South America, as far south as Chile and Argentina, where they have big communities. And these gang members have followed along, in part because kind of similar to like the Italian mafia in the late 19th century,
yeah,
they preyed on their own people, on these migrants, extorting them and committing other crimes.
Now, for all the concerns about Tren de Aragua's presence in the U.S., Juan, it has without a doubt become a much bigger problem in South America, especially in Chile and in the country where you're based, Colombia. Tell us about the criminal chaos the gang has wrought in those countries, from drug trafficking to extortion to prostitution rings, right?
Exactly. I mean, in Colombia, the authorities here told me that they started, that the gang probably arrived here around 2018. So we're talking about, you know, 6 years, basically. And it would make sense. Colombia shares a very long border with Venezuela.
Oh, sure.
There's
yeah,
a lot of Venezuelans here, about 3 million. And so they set up in Bogota, in the capital, and then they've spread to other cities. Now, they were initially involved in just fighting other gangs in some of the rougher neighborhoods here for, you know, the petty drug trade, extortions and stuff. But authorities here have told me that they've grown far bigger and more powerful, that they're trying to get into migrant smuggling, that they're involved in sort of bigger scale drug trafficking and so forth. Some of the leaders of the gang who had set up here in Colombia were also involved in overseeing crime in other countries.
Uh-huh.
So Chile, which is far away
yeah.
and doesn't have, you know, the same experience as Colombia has with powerful gangs, they were really kind of overtaken and overwhelmed by this gang because of the violence that they committed there, which they had not seen in Chile. And they were doing a bit of the same things, you know, a lot of prostitution, extortion, drug trafficking, and killing people.
They were also
one very important case, a political killing.
Yeah, they were also.
I'm sorry.
Oh no, no, yeah. Please point. Yeah, I just wanted to get to that. The fact that a dissident, a Venezuelan dissident, who opposes the dictatorship in Venezuela, who had taken refuge in Chile, was allegedly murdered by Tren de Aragua in Chile. But is there still a feeling that they did that at the behest of the Venezuelan government?
Well, none of this is set in stone, and it's a little bit unclear. But the Chilean authorities have said that this was a political crime and that this came out of Venezuela. In other words, that this idea of killing this dissident originated out of Venezuela. They shied away from actually blaming the Venezuelan government, the Venezuelan regime, at least publicly. But they said it was a political crime. And they also said that a couple of the Tren de Aragua guys involved allegedly in that killing had gone back to Venezuela, and they wanted the Venezuelans to turn them over,
right.
Which, of course, hasn't happened.
So a huge headache in Chile. But so then let's pivot to Tren de Aragua's sudden appearance in the U.S. And your Wall Street Journal report starts with an interesting anecdote involving a Homeland Security investigations official based here in Miami. Tell us about that.
Well, sure. That Homeland Security official is Anthony Salisbury.
Right.
He's a very experienced investigator and official in that agency, and he's been investigating gangs for many, many years across, you know, a wide swath of Latin America and the United States. And he told me that he got a call from some Texas officials who said to him, "Hey, have you heard about the Tren de Aragua?" And his take was, "Oh, please don't tell me you've seen them." And apparently they had. This was, you know, late last year. So he said that these guys were starting to see the Tren in Texas. And now, of course, we're getting a lot of news about the Tren de Aragua and its activities in Texas, particularly in San Antonio. But also in other places.
But Saul's,
add one thing to him that.
No. I just wanted to ask quickly. Salisbury gets this call from Texas as he and other law enforcement officials here in Miami are dealing with a Tren de Aragua case that involves an alleged murder. No, here in Miami.
Exactly, the murder apparently of a former Venezuelan police officer who had settled in Venezuela, in Miami. I'm sorry, like a lot of Venezuelan people have. And who was lured to his death in a case that the authorities there said appeared to have been handled by Tren de Aragua members.
Now, I'm sorry, Juan, I interrupted you there as you were starting to make another point about this. Please go ahead.
Yeah, one point I was going to make about Texas is that a couple of the organized crime prosecutors in Colombia who talked to me had also told me that Texas authorities had come to Bogota, here to Colombia, to ask about the Tren de Aragua and find out what the Colombians know. So the U.S. law enforcement officials have been working quite closely with Colombian officials because Colombian officials have had to deal with this first.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Wall Street Journal South America Bureau Chief Juan Forero about the Venezuelan gang called Tren de Aragua that is now in the U.S. presidential election headlines. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Juan, you report that there are more than 100 criminal investigations in the U.S. now involving Tren de Aragua, including some troubling cases in New York, but also, as I mentioned before, places as far-flung as Aurora, Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. Homeland Security said that there were 100 cases involving these members. I focused quite a bit on New York because the NYPD said it had seen a lot of activity from this gang as some of these gangbangers had shown up in New York with the large number of Venezuelan migrants who settled in New York City. Mm-hmm. And so what they had seen there is, you know, the case of Venezuelan gang members on mopeds, robbing people in the streets, and also sort of these big operations where they just sort of swarm a fancy store and just kind of wipe it clean before the police can arrive. In addition to that, some drug trafficking in Queens. So they have talked quite a bit about how this is a really serious thing. I even saw like a high-level police official talk on local television just this week about a bunch of crimes in Times Square involving members of this gang.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you report, Juan, violent crime is actually down in the United States, crimes like homicide, down considerably in the U.S. these days, and the country is much safer than it used to be. Nevertheless, Tren de Aragua has become a focal point, as I mentioned, of the immigration debate that's dominating the presidential election here because these gang members did manage to cross the U.S. southern border. Former President Trump has made the claim that the Venezuelan dictatorship is opening up its prisons and letting Tren de Aragua members out to come to the U.S. That's a debatable point, obviously. But what has U.S. law enforcement learned about how many of the Tren de Aragua members were able to cross the southern border, perhaps relatively undetected?
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of details about that. I mean, what they do know is that these guys did cross into the United States via the southern border. We know, of course, from a lot of the reporting that's been done on the southern border and from the court system and so forth, that it's fairly easy to get across and has been. And a lot of migrants simply say that they are seeking political asylum. They get in. And they await court cases down the road, which can take years to finally be resolved. And so quite easy to make your way into the United States and settle there.
Yeah.
And so some of these gang members have come in with those migrants in very much the same modus operandi.
All that said, though, in your reporting, do U.S. authorities see Tren de Aragua and the Tren de Aragua problem here as apocalyptically, let's say, as former President Trump does? Do they represent the, quote, immigrant gang invasion crisis that Trump and his campaign are painting it as? Did U.S. authorities agree with that, do you think?
I don't think so because, you know, obviously U.S. authorities and law enforcement authorities have a whole different viewpoint on this. I mean, their idea is to basically try to contain this. And Trump's efforts are basically to make this a major campaign theme. I think what's interesting, though, is while Trump exaggerates perhaps the danger and so forth, and of course, certainly the danger of immigrants in and of themselves, because it is apocalyptic the way he lays it out.
Sure.
I also think on the other side, on the Democratic side, there's also, you know, an effort to try to downplay this as much as possible.
Right.
Because people are clearly going to be upset that immigrants are coming in, including violent criminals, illegally. I mean, that's what upsets people about.
Juan, unfortunately, I have to leave it there for time. I really appreciate you coming on. Juan Ferreiro is the Wall Street Journal South America Bureau Chief. He spoke to us from Bogota, Colombia. Juan, many thanks. Finally on the roundup, Vice President Kamala Harris, the Democratic presidential nominee, held her town hall with undecided Hispanic voters last week in Las Vegas on Univision. Former President Trump, the Republican nominee, held his here in Miami on Univision on Wednesday. As expected, immigration was one of the questions raised, and Trump responded in his usual and usually untruthful way about immigrants arriving at the U.S. southern border.
Hundreds of thousands of people that are murderers, drug dealers, terrorists. They're coming in totally. Nobody knows who they are, where they come from. And the people that are most against it are the Hispanic people. They are totally against it, what's happened.
Again, Trump's generalization there about migrants is grossly untrue. But what about that last part, his assertion that most Hispanics agree with him and his anti-immigrant rhetoric? Is that true? If you look nationally, where polls show Harris leads Trump among Hispanics by a wide margin, maybe not. But inside Florida, well, here, Trump leads Harris among Hispanics by a wide margin, 18 points, according to a new poll out this week. No wonder Trump chose Miami as the site of his Hispanic town hall. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.